All right, good morning and good afternoon to everyone. Welcome to the Thought Leader and Industry Innovator series. Today is part of a three-part series, Paradoxes and Dilemmas of an Ethical Will and a Family Trust. Today's purposeful quote is, "I have learned that an ethical will can do harm if they come from a desire to control instead of to teach. If it becomes a grudge from the grave, then it can cripple the recipient and destroy his capacity to live a good life," by Rabbi Jack Reamer. So I'll let our guest speakers take it away from here.
Lovely. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving. So take a look at page four, Philippe. That's the call to Philippe. And I want to thank Philippe for the amazing visuals that he added to the text, besides his general aesthetic abilities. So page four. So we can
Thank
see
you.
what our topics are for this evening, our last session. I worked really hard to alliterate everything. So we have paradoxes, pitfalls, and paradigm shifts. So we're going to look at the ethical and the financial will, which of course are designed to bring positive benefits to the heirs, but often they end up backfiring. And we'd like to see how those back, what antidotes we might be able to suggest to some of that backfire effect, that dysfunctional aspect of doing what seems to be so good, giving a gift of heritage and a gift of money to your children or to your heirs. And then at the very end, to suggest perhaps a paradigm shift, a different way of defining what the task is instead of the gift of heritage or expanding the notion of the gift of the heritage. The first quotation, the one that Leandra already read to us, is from Jack Reamer. And he writes very beautifully about the way in which the ethical will can do harm. Because he says the ideal of the ethical will is to teach. It's to teach morality, to teach good advice, to help the children. And yet sometimes behind that teaching is really an attempt to control. As he puts it, even after you die, you have a grudge from the grave that continues to cripple the children. So if the goal is to make your children, your heirs, independent, morally people with a strong conscience and with the autonomy to make their own decisions, then the advice can be helpful by avoiding pitfalls, but it can also be such as it creates tremendous lack of self-confidence, and in fact leads to resentment and rebellion, which is why the icebreaker question was, when does parental advice, of course intended, we think, for our benefit, can actually lead to resentment and rebellion and can be totally counterproductive? Let's take a look at the first of those paradoxes on page five. This comes from the beginning of Jack Reamer's book, and it's about the way in which gifts, where a gift, of course, is a nice response. How often did our parents tell us that you have to say thank you when you get a gift, even before you open it? You better say thank you, because when you open it, you might have a frown on your face. Say thank you immediately. So gifts go along with a demand for gratitude. And in doing that, they often end up by guilt tripping. And so if you haven't experienced parental guilt, then let's give a good example from 1,000 years ago. From this is Yehuda ibn Tibbon, a famous physician and scholar and translator from Arabic to Hebrew. His son Samuel Shmuel was even more famous in that field. And Jack Reamer talks about what a wonderful will it is, and he quotes one of the famous quotes from it: "Let books be your companions. Let bookcases and shelves be your pleasure grounds and gardens. Bask in their paradise, gather their fruit, pluck their roses, enjoy their spices and their myrrh." We just donated a bookshelf to my son, for him to put the Talmud that he inherited from his grandfather, and they're now redoing the house in order to make room for the bookshelves. So it's so beautiful. And yet, as Jack Reamer notes, the third paragraph, the will itself runs to over 50 pages, and most of it is full of rebukes and chastisements and laments and self-pity for the father. The father tells his son at great length just how much he has done for him, how hard he's worked for him, how nobly he has sacrificed for him, such an altruist, and how much aggravation the son has given him in return. He goes on for page after page after page, rebuking his son for neglecting his studies, for having bad penmanship. Remember, this is a translator. And he ends by asking his son to read this 50-page list of rebukes twice a day for the rest of his life. It becomes a new liturgy, a new prayer. You can see how incredibly destructive this is. You're using how much I sacrificed for you, not to generate gratitude and appreciation, but to browbeat him and to demand it. And of course, the result is going to be exactly the opposite. Let's take a look now at another example. Turn to page 6. And here we have a quotation from a famous existentialist psychoanalyst named Erich Fromm, originally from Germany, then came to the United States. His father, in fact, was a rabbi, and he was also a Jewish scholar. And this is what he writes, and I think it applies to the Bible, but perhaps also to today. The guilt feelings of the child who has not pleased his father or mother are very complex and hidden. Sometimes the child feels that he has disappointed his parents' expectations. This is particularly true of the authoritarian family, where demands are a central parental role. That's the whole idea of the ethical will, the demands that you have to live up to. Modern patriarchs still have the persistent sense that children were brought into this world to give parents satisfaction and to compensate for their own disappointments in life. Now, when the parents actually are not disappointed, when the parents actually have been very successful in their life, that can also overshadow the children, because how can they possibly live up to repeating what their parents have already accomplished in life? The parents started from nothing, perhaps. They were self-made men and women. And now the child, of course, he's received so much. And so the gap is enormous. And Fromm is suggesting that that's really one of the biggest problems here. The ethical will, by talking about the great heritage, is also generating a sense of inadequacy of the children themselves. Now, I know plenty of jokes about Florida that I've heard and stories. Florida as the place of many, many retired grandparents, especially Jews from the Northeast who go to Florida. And when the grandparents get together, of course, they're no longer involved in their business activities. So what do? They very often end up competing with each other, vicariously taking their children and their grandchildren as items for competition. So if one parent says, my son is a rabbi, the other one says, oh, rabbis, my son is a Wall Street lawyer. If one says, my daughter gave me 4 grandchildren while yours got divorced after a year. So you can see the way in which the parents are using their children as naches producers. Naches is a Yiddish word meaning the duty of children to provide pleasure to their parents by living up to the parents' expectations and being fodder for the competition between the parents, trying to show whose parent or whose grandparent can claim the most naches for them. So that's guilt tripping, a phenomenon I'm sure you're very aware of. Let's take a look at a second paradox on the next page, page 7. And here we have number 2, reaching beyond the grave to micromanage. So on one hand, sometimes parents want to micromanage. On the other hand, the heirs are coming into their own. They're expecting to be their own boss. And precisely at that moment before you hand over the wealth and the power, that's exactly when you try to extend your power further on. Now, we're all very much aware of helicopter parents, right? The parents who, more in the last 30 years than ever before, try to micromanage every moment of their children's upbringing as if they're all from age 2, they're already involved in providing a CV for an Ivy League school. They're planning the extracurricular activities. They're planning everything. A friend of mine who's been watching the series The Crown talks about how Queen Elizabeth does the same thing with all of her children and grandchildren. She's controlling the public face of each one of the family members, not allowing them to be authentic in any way, because she has to maintain the reputation of the firm. And the firm, of course, is the dynasty itself, which is dependent on that public face in many ways. And so I think that an ethical will is very often has to do with that micromanaging to guarantee that the family's heritage will continue. Here's a terrible example, if you'll excuse me. This is from 150 years ago, Michael Zelig HaKohen. He lists 66 instructions for his son in his ethical will. How often he has to have a bath, what utensils he uses, how he shouldn't eat too much, and he shouldn't be too emotional, and he shouldn't be bragging, 66 of them. And he introduces them by saying, "I perceive it as an obligation of every individual parent to instruct his children, to caution them, to remind them of God's will in his Torah and of the character traits of the righteous." Notice the triple guilting. Not only you're not living up to your parent to whom you owe your life, but you're not living up to the model of the righteous or to God himself. My will is God's will, and you better take a bath at least once a day and make sure that you don't you eat properly. Now, even worse is the way he ends his instructions. The next page on page 8. Here it is. This is a time schedule provided by the father for each 24-hour day. Every single half hour is accounted for. Now, these are extreme examples, but of course, the man doing this thought he was benefiting his child. And this reminded me of a wonderful piece that I found on page 9, and that is from Philippe himself, from his wonderful book, The Woes of the Rich. So can I ask you, Philippe, to read that one, please?
With pleasure. So many times I have met with people who tried to pack their wills with rules that would in fact control their heir's life. One client left an inheritance under the provision that his children lead an Orthodox Jewish life, observing the Torah and the commandments. Another heir was forced into fictitious marriage because being married was a prerequisite for receiving her inheritance. One of my clients used to rewrite his will depending on his children's behavior. He ruled the family by capriciously extorting love. This resulted in family conflicts, legal battles, jealousy, lies, lack of faith, and other ills. I worked very hard to finally convince him to stop changing his will every 6 months and instead to limit himself to once every 5 years.
No, so can you give us an update, Philippe? How's the family doing? Have they switched counselors? They've given up on you already?
Not yet, but I had to give in a few things, yes. Otherwise, I wouldn't be there with them.
Now, let me just point out a couple of interesting antidotes for this situation when you're doing your ethical will. And that you can find by looking at page 10. And these are attitudinal changes from the parent's side. So the first one is from Rabbi Chaim and Esther Kival, actually friends of my father, and they wrote an ethical will. And this is what they write along with all their advice to their children. "It would be foolish for us to command you in these matters. You must and you will, of course, live your own lives." And at the very beginning, they begin with the disclaimer, "I know we can't control you." That's already a big step forward for such a powerful parent and as a founder of a business to be able to say, "I can't control my children. They're going to go on because I'm dying. I can't control that." And then they said, "We only hope and pray that as your parents and teachers, we have succeeded in filling your heart with." In other words, their whole list of advice was resources and ideas for their children without any expectation, admitted that the children were going to live the parents' lives instead of living their own lives. Now let's look at a second example. This is also from Providence. Remember the ethical wills that were done in the 1970s. And this is what they say to their child. "We have often disagreed. As you grew older, we differed concerning substantive matters. But I was proud of how you all stood your ground. Even when I attempted to intimidate you, you all thought clearly and argued well. nor were any of you lacking in a sense of humor. Here is a parent writing an ethical will where the basic idea is giving your commands to your children. And in fact, this parent has been working, has been trying to command the children for years and years and years. And she begins by saying, you know what? I've been browbeating you with what I think you ought to do. And I know, but I want you to know that actually I appreciate your independence. I'm happy that even though I tried to intimidate you, and of course the asymmetrical power of the parent to the child, you refuse to be. And I want to confess my own weaknesses. There were times when each of you thought I was unfair, that I was picking on you. Sometimes you were right. Think about it. You will realize that I picked on you when you most behaved like me, at least like those aspects of myself that I liked least, my own weaknesses. In other words, I admit that my criticism wasn't necessarily an objective evaluation of your needs and your issues. It was projecting my own issues. So because I couldn't correct myself, I thought maybe at least I can correct the next generation. And that's certainly a wonderful antidote, I think, in terms of the attitude needed in order to avoid micromanaging and the illusion of control, which ends up by backfiring. Let's take a look at another one. The very next page, page 11. This is the paradox that I call the ethical will and the emperor's new clothes. So in looking through many of the collections of ethical wills, both from Jack Reamer and the ones that I found in John A's collection of wonderful gifts of heritage, they were beautiful. The parents talked about themselves and their own parents, how generous they were, how hardworking they were, how selfless they were, how they cared about people of all different backgrounds. And then they said, be like us. These are the values of our family. Now, the tendency by definition of such a gift of heritage is to idealize what the family has really done and to idealize what the founders have done in their lives. I mean, think about an epitaph on a gravestone. Are you going to really write the weaknesses of the person who's buried there? No, only the best things. In a deep sense, an ethical will, a gift of heritage, is an act of self-promotion by the founder. It's self-congratulatory. It's boasts by its very nature, because you're trying to persuade the heirs that you have a wonderful family heritage that's worth saving. And you want them to identify with the family. But it's almost to be expected that when you're telling your family members what a wonderful family you have, the family members, the children who've seen you at your weakest, they know the hypocrisy of what you're saying. They can see that the emperor's new clothes, there are no new clothes. There is a rabbinic guideline that says that one of the things you're forbidden to do is to tell gossip. Even if the gossip is true, you're not supposed to gossip about people. Now, gossip is usually understood as saying bad things about people, bad but true. But the rabbi said, if I say good gossip and I praise somebody to somebody else, especially somebody else who might be a little bit jealous, I can expect that as soon as I finish the sentence, these people were so selfless, you know the person listening to the gossip will have the desire to tear them down and say, let me tell you about how selfless they really are. And then you're actually inviting negative gossip by giving positive gossip. And I think that's what an ethical will and a gift of heritage has the danger of doing. So to look at an antidote for that, take a look at page 11. That's the page we're on. Here you have a picture he wasn't my teacher, but I certainly heard him speak many times. Abraham Joshua Heschel. He's the guy with the white beard and the white hair. He himself was a refugee from the Nazis. He worked in Germany under the Nazis to help the Jewish community until he was ultimately thrown out of Germany. He went to Poland, and there he was brought to the United States to be a teacher. As he developed in the 1960s, he became a very close friend of Martin Luther King, very much involved both in the struggle against the Vietnam War and, of course, against segregation and racism. That's why you can see him here with Martin Luther King in 1965, crossing the bridge in Montgomery, if I'm not mistaken. And his only daughter remembers the following thing about her father. I'm reading in the box. "My father, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, used to say, 'I have a daughter. I love her dearly. I would like her to obey the commandments of the Torah.'" That's the idea of an ethical will. "I would like her to revere me as her father," one of the Ten Commandments. "I ask myself the question again and again, what is there about me that would be worthy of her reverence? Unless I live a life that would deserve her reverence, I would make it impossible for her to live a life of Judaism." In other words, it's not what you say, but what you do. That really is what determining. So we have this inner contradiction and paradox, the very ethical will and gift of heritage that emphasizes the positive values that supposedly the parents stand for, in fact, reveals the gap between the actual behavior, between the preaching and the practice of the parent. As the wise parents say, "Do as I do and do as I say, not as I do, because what I do doesn't live up to what I'm telling you you ought to be able to do." And sometimes it means that an ethical will has to begin with a confession of one's own weaknesses. It has to confess what I didn't do. And simply by that act of honesty, of saying, "This is what I wanted to do, and this is what I did do," it makes it possible for the heirs who know the parents, in some ways from an angle the parent doesn't know themselves, and it allows them to say, "Okay, if you're going to confess your honesty, then I perhaps, if you're talking negatively about yourself, maybe that's an invitation for me as the heir to talk positively about you rather than the reverse phenomena." Philippe and Jamie are going to be preparing all of these slides, including other materials we didn't get to, as a handbook of a certain kind. And you'll see there's a magnificent story there told by a father who, in his will, his financial will, as well as his ethical will, says the following. Take a look at page 13, and you'll be able to look at the whole of it a little bit later. This is a man in Israel in 1949, before he passes away. He's an immigrant. He talks about the following. "Now I stand at the sunset of my life, I cannot forgive myself for the injustice with which I treated my son Gershon, who is in America." Now you can guess why he's in America. Gershon ran away from his father because he couldn't stand the father's moralizing. And the father wrote him out and left him no inheritance whatsoever. So in this final ethical will, and I'm sure you have examples of this as well, actually, admitting their own weaknesses, the founders, in this case, the father, realizes that he needs to make up for the child that he cut out of his will and didn't give any inheritance to. And then what he does below is he talks about asking all the other children to make sure to share from what they got so that this alienated child, if he ever shows up in Israel, will get his equal fourth share, and perhaps that will make his life forgivable. Take a look at page 16, please. Okay. This will be the last of our paradoxes, and then we'll open it up for some comments. And then at the end, we'll take a look at the suggestion for a paradigm shift. Okay. Now, this is not an example of an ethical will, but of a financial will. Of course, when you give money, you're hoping that the money will be appreciated. It's a gift. It's a gift of grace. But what happens is very often that gift becomes a gift with strings attached. To have a gift with strings attached is an oxymoron, one of my favorite spelling words and a great word from English literature. It means a thing that's a contradiction in and of itself, like hot ice or something like that. And in this case, to give a gift is a gift that's supposed to be an act of grace. But if the gift has strings attached, it turns from generosity into extortion. Could you please read for a moment from your own work, Philippe? Money is not just money.
So money is not just money. It is an instrument of control, a means for extorting love, gratitude, and submission. In my work, I often come across this unhealthy component. For some people, money is transformed in their imagination into a powerful god, and they express their love through it as if it were the only way they know how to say, I love you. Some heirs cannot bear the fact that they are rich just because of their parents, and an exhausting conflict develops among them.
So you see the deep contradiction here. You're giving money, but you're extorting love. Of course, you can't extort love. You can try, but it's not really love. In fact, the very act of giving the gift just emphasizes how much the children are dependent on this godlike giver for their whole lives and even beyond. And so there's the very gift of dependence actually creates the resentment. And here, I'd like you to look at the next page, page 17, just at the visual. And later on, when we give you the handout, you can read what the text is. I love this visual, Philippe. Here you have trying to balance between money and between heart, when in fact, the heart is being extorted with the money itself. And each child has the tendency to see what they got financially as a mark of what their value is and how much they're loved by their parent. I recently read a wonderful book I recommend to you by Michael Sandel, a professor of justice at Harvard University. I had the chance to study with him when he was in Jerusalem at the Hartman Institute. And it's called The Tyranny of Merit. And he suggests that one of the sources of Trump's victory in 2016 is something he calls the resentment of meritocracy. If you believe that the people who are successful in our society at the top levels, both in the Ivy League and in Wall Street, the most financially successful, are also the people who are part of a meritocracy. Isn't that what America is about the possibility of always achieving more and more? So if you don't achieve, you have nobody to blame but yourself. But how can you possibly teach, he says, to all most Americans when the tiny group of the people who are successful is maybe 1%, maybe 5%, maybe 10%. And in America, at least 70% of the people didn't even go to college, let alone an Ivy League school, and then on to a graduate degree and making a lot of money. You're making the people who didn't succeed feel guilty for their relative lack of success, while falsely suggesting the people who did succeed, it really depended on their merit and not on luck, on their family connections, on all kinds of other things. And so I think the same is true when the founder generation who has all this money is handing it over to the children. They're basically saying, I earned this. This is mine. You didn't earn anything. You have no merit. I'm the one who has merit. You're totally dependent on me. And so I'm not at all surprised in a situation like that, that there would be a tremendous amount of resentment. So let me suggest that we open it up to questions or people who would like to give examples of the way in which a financial will or a gift of heritage can in fact backfire. Philippe, can you lead us in the discussion?
So, Leandra, do you know how to open that everyone can talk? Because I can, either you...
Yes, as they raise their hand, I'll unmute them. Ah, okay. And you'll see their video pop up.
Okay, so... let's go ahead. Anyone? Just in the meantime, until people get ready to give comments, Ed just wrote, I don't know if you saw it, Ed just wrote, membership in PPI has cost me a fortune in books. I like that. But Jay is raising his hand. So let me try.
Yes, can you? Can...
Okay, sorry.
Wait, I'm unmuted?
Yes, you unmuted it.
Yeah. Noam, thank you. Profoundly. All three of these conversations have been revealing and deep, and we are all in a spiritual debt to you in a profoundly good way. Thank you. And Philippe and Jamie, thank you also for providing us this gift, which you have extended. And I want to say thank you as well. To you and, of course, to John A. for bringing these remarkable conversations to us. No, what I, as I was listening over the days, and particularly today, I was fascinated in the history of these documents, to some extent, by the influence of Freud, as well as the great influence of the sages of the rabbinical tradition, about the dark side or the shadow side. Dark seems way too strong, but the shadow side of anything that we human beings do, but particularly aware of it in the, let's say, 20th century with the ideas of Freud and Jung and Adler and Rogers and all the others. I'm thinking that if we're asking our clients and ourselves, I'm 78 years old, so probably it's time for me to write one of these myself. I think that we are probably going to have to think through in a very profound way that this morning awakens me to, really think very profoundly about the meteors that we are sending into another's lifetime. And that even the ethical will, and I had not thought of this before these wonderful programs, I've thought a lot, as you know, about the question of whether we are making gifts or transfers with the meteors that we send to the next rising generations. But I hadn't really thought through until today that even an ethical will is a form of meteor into someone else's life. And the very complex questions of the shadow side of our own behaviors that get communicated. So this is not so much a question, it's rather a thank you, a mitzvah for the great mitzvah you've given us, but also to be aware that when we write these, it's a form of meteor, even though we would normally think of the meteors being some thing that we're transferring or giving, that really this document is a meteor in itself. So my apologies for the length of that, but I've been moved and appreciative.
Thank you, Jay.
I would say I love that. And one of the things when I work with clients on an ethical will is to imagine themselves as the recipients and the recipients of that meteor, how it might land. It's often why we do an ethical will, because sometimes I work with parents who say, well, I'm not going to figure that out or explain it. I'll just let the next generation figure it out. So we talk about the kind of meteor that can happen from leaving a vacuum of a lack of information. And I think it's really important that this is the counterpart of that, that you have to think of whatever you send, what might it be like to be the recipient of that information?
Thanks, Jamie.
Steve. So we have Steve Legler.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for this. It's making me think about the word hypocrisy. It seems that a lot of the examples, the hypocrisy of the parents writing this ethical will seemed so obvious to all of us, and we were sort of chuckling about it. And my question is, do the people who are writing these not realize that if they haven't been living their lives in this way, that this, as somebody said, do as I say, not as I do. And isn't that when somebody first reads this, I think the spirit and the attitude that goes into it, either it will be accepted as a learning instrument or it will be quickly dismissed out of hand, and nobody's going to read a document 50 times or a 50 page document twice a day. For that. So just the whole idea of hypocrisy, and why is it so easy for some people to see, but the people who are the hypocrites don't see it?
Let me respond to that in two ways. Number one is, very often the parent really has worked hard to make the money and to build the business and to produce the children. And so in fact, they do have merits. What they don't see and what the kids see is, you spent all the time on the business, but you weren't there for me. So it's actually the parent can easily be blindsided at not realizing that they didn't spend enough time on the family precisely to build the business. It's something that Jay has written about, I know as well. The other side is, the opposite of hypocrisy is, let's say your parent is perfect, right? Like in that first example of Judah ibn Tibbon, he's a great scholar, a great translator. He's very virtuous. What do you do when your parent is that good? And then your parent's trying to micromanage you to be exactly the same. So you can have a perfect parent with no hypocrisy. And that's as bad as having the parent who's a complete hypocrite.
Yeah. And then you also have narcissism, which comes in, which we discussed another time, Norm. Okay, we have Bill, who also asked a question, wants to ask a question.
Yes, I guess my question is, it seems like the parents don't trust them at all. So whether it's an ethical will or the will itself or the trust, I don't trust you, therefore I put the rules down. Yes. So don't the parents really need to change their attitude about how they do all this?
Very nice.
Because they've created this mess with the children. So therefore you got to deal with it, and you can't rule it from the grave or from your will, or from your trust. You can try, but all they do is rebel. They mean well.
But you see, Bill,
not be told it.
You see, Bill, my son is now 18, is being drafted to the army in another month or so. And I'm still seeing that little baby which I held in my hands. How can that be that he's being drafted to the army? Well, he takes his own decisions. I have to help him take his decisions. I know better. It happens to me.
But see,
it happens
you haven't
to me.
Let him become an adult. He hasn't come. You got to let him become an adult.
I know. We all know that.
You can't see him as your kid.
We all know that, but we see the baby. So it always needs convincing yourself that actually he is big and he should take his own decisions and make his own mistakes. The famous Lisa I saw, but the famous saying about the butterfly which comes out of his cocoon, and he's fighting to get out of the cocoon, and then you try to crack it open so that he can get out easier, and then he can't fly, because he needs that work of training his muscles to be able to fly. So you can't help him; he has to fly himself. Lisa Orlik.
Thank you. I have a quick question. So Noam, Jamie, Philippe, do you have an example of an ethical will that is grounded in the wholeness of a relationship in the present, in the living space, that is very simple and elegant in that it distills some very simple values and gives very clear direction? Like, for example, it might be enough to say, treat others as you want to be treated. So that's all, you know? Just a simple guidance that we, in our daily life, you have examples of how we live that. So the ethical will is not so much a directive, but actually a reflection of the way we live. Can we, as you know, guides, help our clients to live that versus plan for it only?
Actually, Lisa, in the first session we did, almost quoting you, we quoted some of the other statements from Hillel, like the one you just did, and also, John A. in his materials has that. You can avoid the personal and simply say, these are the principles by which I live. And then you quote Emerson and you quote Hillel and you quote quotes like that. And you can keep it, in that sense, sterile and separate from the parental relationship. The ethical will and the gift of heritage, however, is an attempt to generate the wisdom out of the experience and the identity of the family as a family. Now, that's a lot more complicated, right? Your method clearly avoids lots of conflicts, the accusation of hypocrisy or micromanaging or whatever it might be. But we're looking also at this attempt to deal with the actual heritage. That is, there is a heritage that the children have gotten from their parents. It may not be what the parents really intended. In fact, it might even be the opposite. But somehow this gift of heritage, this attempt to personalize my life and at the same time to recognize my own weaknesses and to make room for the children's innovation, to say that as a parent rather than simply quoting some beautiful, beautiful piece from Goethe or whatever, that has its own value, but it's much more difficult to do, of course.
So Noam, my question then is maybe to rephrase it. What if the ethical will was merely a reflection that you actually asked the children to write the ethical will that they would have their parents give them that basically integrates the values and all of this heritage that the parents want to convey, that would be enough for the parent to know this is what has root in my children's life?
Lovely. Well, I'm going to send you a check and thank you for giving me that segue.
Okay.
Because that's exactly what I'd like to do with the last 15 minutes is to talk about a potential paradigm shift. Is that okay,
Noam,
Philippe?
Or Noam, we have three raised hands.
Okay.
So, and we have another 18 minutes. So
okay.
Shall we try to get
to
those three people and then we'll talk faster afterwards. Okay. I think the first was Catherine. So I unmute. Oops. I now muted her. Sorry. No, Susan. Susan?
Yes. Along the lines of what Lisa just mentioned. Was that your name? I think who just...
Yes.
So, you know, to make this kind of a message rather than an instruction really speaks to me. And one book that I think is a very beautiful book is called The Four Things That Matter Most by Ira Byock. And he works with people at the end of their lives. And he says the four things that people need to say before they die are one of these four things. One is, thank you. I love you. Forgive me. Thank you. I love you. Forgive me. I forgive you. And I love that as an idea, as a way to start an ethical will that is a message, that's something very personal that the children probably want to hear more than anything else, you know, that they mattered to you. So I think it's a really beautiful way to start if you're thinking about it more as a message that the children will take or leave as they need to at different times in their lives, rather than strictly something that's only about heritage.
Thank you. That's beautiful.
Catherine?
I was listening to this and thinking about the work that we do with clients during their lifetime, where it's a real sort of intergenerational exchange of views. And, you know, one thing I always say is clients shouldn't be surprising their children with views, whether it's a structure or whether it's sort of an ethical will at the end of their lifetimes. Nothing that's contained in it, in my mind, should be a surprise. And I wonder the interplay of this with lifetime, you know, family values work, family purpose, where you're introducing the family's heritage and you're sharing the values, but in a way that's interactive with the children, as opposed to something that comes later on in life.
Terrific. Thank you.
And we also have Grant. So Grant, please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. It kind of builds on the previous comments. I think other people have covered this a bit, but the reflection aspect of it, should this not be more of a continuous process and even an annual event, and kind of as Catherine was just alluding to, rather than a surprise or a big build up to the end of life? I was just thinking, would you recommend doing this every year, even if it's just a reflective process for the parents?
It's ideal.
I know of a family who does something similar. They have once a year to a year end after Christmas, they do a day where they all have a binder where they write down their wishes and their dreams for the next year. And then the year after, they go over it and they'll check out, what did you do? What did you achieve? Some of them is for multi-year or a life achievement. So they keep, and they always work on this binder. Everyone has his own, and it's a activity for the family. So very nice.
Thank you.
Okay. Is Susan again raising hand, or it's still from before? I don't know. Yes.
Let me take the last bit, may I?
Exactly, go ahead, yes.
Okay. So your comments are perfect, and they also form a very nice bridge. So following your comments, I would like to suggest that maybe we need to have a paradigm shift from the gift of heritage, or even from the financial will. If you take a look at page 19, okay, well, that's where we're going to work. 19, okay? So the model, which is deeply built into our cultural structure, is a monarchical one. I, the founder, the bequester, it's my money. And I made this money on my own. I'm self-made. And I did the hard work. Not only that, but I also produced you children and grandchildren. I am your biological as well as your financial progenitor. And by the way, legally speaking, it all belongs to me. So I'm going to decide what I'm going to give, to whom I'm going to give, and by what, and at the same time. Now, all of that total control element, there's an element of truth to it. It's certainly reinforced by the society we live in, this sense of my personal property. But actually, we know that there's a structural contradiction, because the owner wants more than to be the owner. He wants to be appreciated with true gratitude. He wants love, not just fealty and submission. The founder knows that if there's going to be any immortality, any continuity to his life and to the family he created and the business, it will depend on the relationship he builds with these independent heirs that are going to go on living without him with the money. And therefore, they have to understand that's in their own interest that they have to let go of control and build a collaborative model. So perhaps what we need to do is to suggest a document, which is the writing of a family-wide gift of heritage. Something like I can't remember which person it was. I know it was a female voice who talked about the fact that, with a great British accent, right? It's an interactive process. But let's define it that way from the beginning. The word ethical will, in fact, the notion will, as in willpower, as in to control, that's part of the danger here. Even the notion of the gift is a problem. If we call it the treasure of the family heritage, and we ask everybody in the family to contribute what they have learned and how they understand the better angels of the family heritage, perhaps also how they understand some of the demons, or in Jay's language, the shadows of their family heritage, and then talk about where they'd like to go with that. That would be an interactive one. In fact, one of the ideas I suggested in the last session, following the model of the Jewish Passover Seder, is to have the children ask questions. What do they want to learn from the other members of their family? But also the parents have to learn, as you suggested, they have to learn, what did the children get from the heritage that they lived even before it's put into words? And of course, everybody in a family sees different angles. So that collective model is the beginning of the transformation. And here, a way of thanking Jay for his comments is to read a wonderful comment he makes on page 19 at the top. The paradox of trying to hand over a dream. Ivan Landsberg's book, Succeeding Generation, describes the deepest paradox of the will. The founder seeks to hand over his dream. He wants continuity, which has become a reality in his business, to the next generation, which has not dreamed that dream. He asked them to fulfill a dream that was never theirs. So the question, how do you hand over a dream, is different than how do you hand over advice or how do you hand over money. Philippe, could you read your section on letting go, please?
So letting go. The first generation's role in planning for heirs quite often has difficulty in letting go vacating their place, resigning from their role as ruler and developing the role of mentor, counselor, the possessor of knowledge who enables his children to grow alongside him, thanks to the constructive criticism and the sense of security.
So here I think, Philippe, you're defining a paradigm shift. And I think that has to be made explicit to the people we're talking to in the family. How do you go from being the person who is the person who's in control to the person who's a mentor? A mentor, an enabler, judges the success not by the willingness of the mentee to imitate everything the mentor says, but rather by the ability of the mentee to go on and to be independent and to think for himself or herself, just as the mentor did when he was independent. Instead of moral put-downs and judgmental comments, you're looking for constructive criticism. And your goal is the autonomy, the security, the self-confidence of the person that you're guiding. Of course, what the big message is, and Jamie talked about this as one of the quotations in a previous session, is the famous quotation from Goethe. There are only two lasting bequests we can give our children. One is roots and the other is wings. But actually, we don't give a bequest of wings. We let go so they can have the wings to create their own additions. We hope that they will build their wings on our roots. But you never know from the roots what the tree is going to look at. You want it to have more ability to take off beyond the roots. And therefore, let's turn to the next page and see what Jay has to tell us about how he would create a collaborative model. This is page 20, a collaborative model. Jay, would you like to read?
Wait, let me find him.
Is Jay there? If not,
allowed to talk. I put him up.
Okay. Thank you, Noam. I'm going to do my best, but I because I have to keep moving my cursor. I have an old screen. Sharing their dreams. These families that succeed in handing over the capital to the next generation, and I would say today the rising generation, for the sake of continuity of the family legacy, know that the more common family practice of the older generation asking the younger to dream the older generation's dreams will ultimately defeat their family's wealth preservation efforts. They know, as I believe, that no one can dream another's dream. In my opinion, the secret to successful long-term family wealth preservation lies in the older generation asking the younger, what are you passionate about and how can I invest in it?
Let me stop right there. You've said yes. It all there. It's beautiful. Thank you, Jay. It's just
and no, really may inspiring. May I add, I made a little comment on the chat to remind us all in this wonderful place where we are right now of the new paradigm that Eric Erickson and his wife remind us that when we come to the eighth stage of our lives, the ones I'm in, the one I'm in and my wife is in, and the one we're thinking about, he says, if we do not learn wisdom as integrity, we are destined to die in despair. And I think what you're bringing to us in this paradigm is the deep wisdom of Erickson and so many other great sages.
Yes.
That it is the doing of what Philippe writes about, what you've said, I hope what I'm saying here, that is the means of living the eighth stage well and not falling to the negative side of the eighth stage, which is despair.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, I had two different ways to end our session today. One way is what's on page 20. I'm sorry, not 20, but 21, I think it is. No, 21, oh. Right? And this I'm going to recommend you look at later. It's a wonderful piece that John A. put together called The Abraham Trust. And it's a wonderful thing about how a parent encourages the child to be themselves and not to be a carbon copy of the parent. I'm going to allow you to read that later. And I would like to end with something more poetic with a poem, my favorite poem, and that's on page 23. This is a poem from Yehuda Amichai, who was who came from Germany as a refugee to Israel, became really the poet laureate of the younger generation in Israel. And here he talks about, if you will, the ethical will from his father, the way his father tried to teach him the Ten Commandments. Isn't that an ethical will? But his father added two more commandments. And I think it captures one of the things that, again, I can't remember exactly which one of the participants said this, the idea that instead of commanding your children, you're giving them a kind of open-minded, an open-ended advice for them to consider. Now, look how he takes that notion and transfers it into a beautiful poem. And with that, we will end. My father, writes Yehuda Amichai, was a god and did not know it. He gave me the Ten Commandments, neither in thunder nor in fury, neither in fire nor in cloud, but rather in gentleness and love. He added caresses and kind words. He added, I beg you and please. In other words, he didn't give commandments with a sense of ethical authority that these are the words of God and the words of your father who is your God, but rather he's a God who begs you, please. He sang Shamor keep and Zachor remember the Shabbat, the fourth commandment, in a single melody. And he pleaded and cried quietly between one utterance and the next. Do not take the name of God in vain. Do not take it in vain. I beg you, do not bear false witness against your neighbor. And he hugged me tightly and whispered in my ear, do not steal. Do not commit adultery. Do not murder. And he put the palms of his open hand on my head with the Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement blessing. Honor, love your parents in order that your days might be long on the earth. And my father's voice was white like the hair on his head. Later on, he turned his face to me one last time, like on the day when he died in my arms and said, I want to add two to the Ten Commandments. The 11th commandment, thou shalt not change. Here is the plea for continuity. Here is the plea to maintain the identity of the family created by the founder in the child. But then he added, and the 12th commandment, thou must surely change, not only roots, but wings. So said my father, and then he turned from me and walked off, disappearing into his strange distances. Thank you very much. I really had a wonderful time preparing this to my partners, Jamie and John A. and Jay and Philippe. And it was lovely to meet the PPI community, even without wearing a mask.